Hello and welcome to Pacifica's national coverage of the Super Tuesday presidential nomination contests. I'm Ian Masters, the host of Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And I'm joining you from the studios of KPFK in Los Angeles, California, hosting this hour of special programming as the results begin to come in from today's Super Tuesday's elections across the country. Covering tonight's results and their indications of who could lead the Republican and Democratic parties in this year's presidential elections and what it might mean for the country, we have the prominent economist at the University of Texas, James Galbraith, who was executive director of the Joint Economic Committee of Congress and is the author of Inequality, What Everyone Needs to Know. He will give us an update on the Cruz-Trump battle in Texas and provide an analysis of Bernie Sanders' economic program that has been under attack, as well as trying to assess what kind of economic plan a President Trump has in store to provide huge growth and amazing jobs that will make us great again. And examining the Cruz, Rubio, Trump, Clinton, and Sanders foreign policy landscapes ahead, we have Jacob Harburn, a senior editor at The National Interest. Among other things, he will explore the possibility that a Donald Trump foreign policy might be to the left of Hillary Clinton's, something that already has the neocons hyperventilating, as Jacob has observed in his recent article, Why Trump is Panicking Robert Kagan. And looking into the two big constituencies in the South that will decide the winner on the Republican side, the evangelicals, and on the Democratic side, the African-American churches, Anthea Butler joins us. She is the chair of religious studies at the University of Pennsylvania and author of The Gospel According to Sarah, How Sarah Palin and the Tea Party Are Galvanizing the Religious Right. And finally, joining us later in the studio, subject to L.A. freeway traffic, Antonia Gonzalez will provide an analysis of the influence of the Latino vote in today's elections. He is the president of the largest and oldest Latino voter participation organization in the U.S., the Southwest Voter Registration Education Project, which has tripled Latino registration from 5.4 million in 1994 to more than 14 million in 2012. And joining us now is, let me introduce James Galbraith, the Chair of Government and Business Relations at the LBJ School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin. He was Executive Director of the Joint Economic Committee of the U.S. Congress, and his books include Created Unequal, The Crisis in American Pay, The Predator State, and his latest, Inequality, What Everyone Needs to Know. Welcome to the program, James Galbraith.
Good evening. Yeah, good to be with you.
And let me introduce Jacob Harburn, a senior editor at The National Interest and author of They Knew They Were Right, The Rise of the Neocons. Previously, he was an editorial writer for the Los Angeles Times and a senior editor at The New Republic. And he has an article at The National Interest, Why Trump is Panicking Robert Kagan. Welcome to the program, Jacob Harburn.
Thank you, Ian.
And Anthea Butler is a professor of religious studies and graduate chair in the Department of Religious Studies at the University of Pennsylvania. Her most recent book, Women in the Church of God in Christ, Making a Sanctified World, chronicles the history of African-American women's religious lives and civic engagement in the Church of God in Christ, the largest Pentecostal denomination in the United States. And her latest book is The Gospel According to Sarah, How Sarah Palin and the Tea Party Are Galvanizing the Religious Right. Welcome to the program, Anthea Butler.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
And already the polls, of course, have closed an hour ago in Georgia, where Trump is the projected winner and Hillary Clinton on the Democratic side. In Vermont, Trump is ahead of Kasich, and Bernie Sanders has been declared the winner in Vermont. And in Virginia, Trump is ahead of Rubio, and Hillary Clinton has been declared the winner. So let me start with James Galbraith in Texas. Obviously, the polls close now and in an hour. I don't know why there's two different times in Texas, but is there anything to report?
Not so far as I'm aware, no.
And what's your sense then of whether it'll be – this could be the last stand for Trump, of course, if he doesn't win. I mean, for Cruz, if he doesn't win.
Oh, I assume it's very difficult for Ted Cruz, but the scene in the Republican Party has been developing pretty clearly for the last several weeks. And, I'm not a professional political observer, but it doesn't take one to tell which direction this is taking.
And, of course, that is an extraordinary event in itself, isn't it, that somebody that could become president of the United States has basically said so little so far, but has gained so much. How do you explain that?
Well, you know, Donald Trump's does not have an economic policy to speak of. It's a policy of bluster, basically, of tough talk. Ted Cruz has an economic policy that's straight out of the late 19th century, quite elegant in that respect, and complete deregulation of labor and the return to the gold standard. So I'm quite content to let the Republicans muddle their way through to their convention. It's clear that where economic policy is being made and where the future of the agenda is being decided right now is on the Democratic side of the spectrum, where you have an enormous development, I think, in American politics, which is the articulation of an agenda that has captured the imagination of millions of young people in America. That is something which is truly of significance, and it will be significant whatever the outcome of the presidential race may be, what the nomination of the nominating race may be.
And indeed, Bernie Sanders is not just one Vermont, but it looks as if CNN is saying that he's likely to win Oklahoma and Massachusetts.
Jacob, that's exceptional.
Yeah.
That really is quite something.
No,
tells you that this race is going to go on.
And Jacob, what's your sense of where we, what drama we are to expect tonight, given the extraordinary focus that has been on Donald Trump, who has captured all the headlines in a way that is hard to understand, but not surprising in the sense that it's almost like a cage fight watching Republican debates nowadays.
Well, politically, the key is whether Rubio wins Virginia or not, which I guess is neck and neck right now. And Rubio would certainly be emboldened to continue campaigning all the way to the end. I wonder if anyone else hasn't thought about this, but maybe it actually helps Trump to have Rubio or Cruz sniping at him all the way to the convention, because basically this is a theatrical race for Trump. If he has an adversary, it'll actually help keep more attention focused on him throughout
sure.
the primary.
Well, Trump's actually in Virginia's at 37% and Rubio's at 30.7%. So
I guess it's changed since I last
yeah.
bought.
Well, we'll try and keep it up to refresh it as we go along. Anthea Butler, what's your sense then of the, I guess morality and politics are not exactly, they're pretty strange bedfellows, but my sense is that this is a very a dark year in a way in terms of the discourse. And I noticed in her victory speech in South Carolina, Hillary Clinton sort of outlined the contours of her campaign by calling, for the better angels of our nature. Do you think that's how this campaign is going to be defined? Hillary talking about inclusion and our better instincts, and Donald Trump doing the opposite?
Yes, I do. But I also think that the vitriol from all of this is going to wash all over us, and we're all going to have to take an acid before it's over. I think that you're right about the performance aspect of all of this. Trump needs people to, be a foil against. And I think that the moral issues that are involved are very deep and telling, and they are renting the evangelicals apart right now. So we're going to see a lot more hate than we are going to see love. It was nice to hear Hillary talk about 1 Corinthians 13, but I think this is going to move into the apocalyptic area of Revelation before it's all over with.
Well, that's, I think, the Left Behind books are the biggest bestsellers, I think, in the history of U.S. publishing. So there's clearly a constituency that have an investment in the end of the world. They want our world to end in burning flesh for their world to begin. It's something akin to hubris, I would say, but nevertheless, I suppose another way to put it would be spiritual pornography. But James Galbraith, given that the CNN is showing, they're not projecting, that they're showing that Bernie Sanders is likely to win Massachusetts and Oklahoma. He has over 50% in both exit polls, and with Hillary Clinton around 45%. With Vermont, your sense is that, and he said in his victory speech in Vermont that he's going to win hundreds of delegates. So he's staking out some territory there, isn't he?
I think so, and this will now go on to the 35 remaining states, which include, of course, all of the big states in the North and West that have not yet been heard from. So, you know, this is a discussion that will continue. And it will continue, as I said before, well past this election, because you do have a generational divide, and it's very clearly emerged in the Democratic Party. And what you're seeing amongst the young voters is an openness to an agenda for change, which was not presented to them by anybody else up till now. It wasn't presented by in the administration of President Obama, hadn't been presented by Hillary Clinton's campaign. And so whatever happens, anybody who wants to have a political future in the Democratic Party is going to have to respond to that agenda. So what Bernie Sanders is achieving here is something that I think is quite fundamental, win, lose, or draw on this race. But as you say, the fact that he's picking up three states so far tonight is, I think, a sign that this isn't over yet. We shall have to wait until the really big players come onto the stage and see what the voters there have to say.
And there's been a flap over his economic plan that you've done an analysis of it, obviously somewhat overheated criticism. But I find it extraordinary to think that that people, for example, have any objection to the notion that we've indentured a whole generation of kids with student debt. And one of the paradoxes of so much of what Bernie Sanders said reminds me in many ways of FDR. After all, he saved capitalism during the Depression. And by reining in Wall Street, I think you, in effect, are saving capitalism, aren't you? And by allowing kids not to be indentured for life, you actually improve the economy because you give them purchasing power that they can...
Absolutely. And what happened in this episode was the number of big-name economists basically pulled rank and attempted to slap down what was an independent analysis of the effect of Sanders, the economic effect of Sanders' plan. And they were attempting basically to create a media wave in which the Sanders program would be declared to be completely impossible and eccentric. And that didn't happen. What happened was instead that there's been a general recognition that the plan needs to be judged on its own merits. It's clear that if you provided a path to debt-free education, if you provided a path to bankruptcy-free medical care, to universal health insurance, that you would be creating a world for the American population, and particularly for those who aren't already protected by Medicare and Social Security, to have enough security to really go out and prosper in today's economy. And that has the capacity to capture the imagination of the whole country. So I think that the fact that the big names of the economics profession came out to say, oh, no, nothing can be done. We're already very close to capacity. We can't grow any faster. We can't absorb any, can't create any significant number of new jobs. Simply worked to diminish their credibility with the broader public. And that, again, there's going to be plenty of time left in this campaign to debate these issues, and I'm looking forward to carrying that debate forward.
Jacob Harbert,
I had a question for James, actually.
Go ahead.
Which was regarding Trump. He does have an economic impulse, at least, which is that he's calling or would be ready to have a trade war with China, maybe Japan. How effective can Trump be at cutting in to the white working class vote in the Rust Belt states with belligerent appeal to raising tariffs, protecting jobs at home, and appealing, denouncing political correctness, and following a program where he says he won't cut entitlement programs, And, you know, he could come out and say, he could take some of Sanders' program and just say, I'll get rid of all student debt. I mean, what's your take on that approach for Trump?
I think it's a very interesting question, and I think the answer, how effective it would be politically, would depend upon who he's up against. I would suspect that if you were up against Bernie Sanders or the Sanders program as the program of the Democratic Party, he would not be successful or terribly successful with that approach, because he would be up against a concrete alternative to which people can also relate. If he's, on the other hand, up against a program which is basically, we're going to continue along our current path, we're going to continue with these trade deals, the TPP and the TTIP, which are people are reasonably and rightfully suspicious. If he's up against the Hillary Clinton campaign that's going on now, I suspect that he may make some serious inroads in those states.
Now, Anthea Butler, let's talk about the as I mentioned in the opening, the two big issues, if you will, in terms of the constituencies, the largest and most influential constituencies on both the Republican side and the Democratic side in these largely southern primary votes that are taking place. The Christian right, the evangelicals on the Republican side, and the African-American churches on the Democratic side. One of the things I found extraordinary in about the South Carolina race that Hillary won so handily is that she's winning throughout the South, but none of these states the Democrats are going to carry in the general. So do you see a disconnect there?
Yeah, but I think, you know, for me, this is the disconnect. The disconnect isn't that it's happening. The disconnect is that these black churches have some of the same kind of belief systems that the evangelicals do. So that's what's interesting. And I think where we might see some slippage is something that you both were previously talking about before, which is the economic piece. And I think that we don't see black churches coming out 100% for Hillary. They may be about 85-90%. But there's a small percentage of people who are in what we call prosperity gospel churches that have been following after Donald Trump, who really like him a lot, and they have been voting for him. And so I think that in the general, we're going to see some of those people sort of slip away from Hillary. On the evangelical side, I mean, it's the evangelical South kind of basically, right? So a lot of those evangelicals are voting Republican. And tonight, I think we might see a surprise, because right now Oklahoma is looking a little bit weird. And it may be that if Cruz can pull out a win in Oklahoma and get Texas too, then we have a different kind of a race. And maybe Trump doesn't walk all over everybody like they used to. So I think in a way, maybe when we end up after Tuesday in November, the biggest thing that I would probably predict is that no matter who wins, evangelicals in America are going to be torn into, and maybe even some more pieces than that, because of this election and because of the kinds of choices that people are making for Donald Trump, who basically doesn't have the, you know, doesn't care about the moral issues, wants Planned Parenthood to be funded. And on the other half, which is Hillary Clinton, where she'll get a lot of black church votes, but will she get young black millennials? That is a big question. I'm not sure she's going to get them the way she thinks she is. So we've got some questions to answer, and we'll see what the next few months bring out.
But why, to begin with, it's extraordinary, isn't it, that a thrice-divorced casino owner who's given to expletives is winning any of the evangelical vote, let alone the majority of it?
Well, yeah. I mean, for some of us, it just shows the hypocrisy of all the things that, you know, evangelicals have been talking about for the last 30 years. But I also think that what is the bigger issue for evangelicals is that, as what Trump is selling is, you know, we're going to make America great again. And evangelicals have had some losses. They lost on same-sex marriage. The same-sex marriage came through. They have tried all of these dirty tricks about abortion and trying to cut abortion in the states, especially like Texas and other places, and they've tried to cut funding for Planned Parenthood. So, you know, to follow after somebody like Mr. Trump, it sounds like to me that the things that they have been saying all along are not the things that they really believe in. But I think that we have to bring up one thing that, you know, I don't hear a lot of people talking about, but I've said it a lot, and I think it's very true. Evangelicalism and race is a big issue. And I think that we would find that, you know, some evangelicals, unfortunately, are also racist. And this, you know, I have a joke that I always tell people is like, you know, evangelicalism codes white for everyone. And once you say that, then it's not too surprising to see why these people might follow Donald Trump despite his, you know, three wives and, you know, curse words and everything else, because they are invested in what Mr. Trump is selling. You would think that they would bail after hearing all the KKK things this weekend, but they have not. So I think that's a judgment on what evangelicals have been talking about the last few years and the kinds of morality that they've been trying to impose upon everyone else.
And Jacob Harburn, again, the senior editor at the National Interest, your article, Why Trump is Panicking, Robert Kagan, of course, indicates disquiet amongst the neoconservatives who very much would come back if Rubio were to become president. You've also suggested that in many ways, well, first of all, you're saying that Kagan and the neocons would probably support Hillary Clinton before they'd support Trump. Could this be an interesting foreign policy discourse in this election year with Trump sometimes sounding more like Rand Paul and Hillary Clinton sounding more like, you know, the neocons of old?
Well, yeah, Hillary Clinton is a liberal hawk. I mean, the Times did this two-part investigative story on her advocacy of intervening in Libya, which turned into a disaster. And it's clear that the neoconservative, or many neoconservatives, feel far more comfortable with her than they do with Trump. There has just been a fusillade of pieces by leading neocons, from Kagan to Max Boot to Jennifer Rubin in the Washington Post, all excoriating Trump. And Trump, well, again, it's too much to say that he has a coherent foreign policy. At least from what he's indicated in general terms, he does not, you know, he was quite direct in denouncing Bush and Cheney for the Iraq War. You know, he said it was sold with lies. Again, he was taking GOP orthodoxy head on. And I think he did that very deliberately in that South Carolina debate, because he wanted to prove that he could take it on and survive and thrive, which he is. So for the neoconservatives, he truly does represent a nightmare, because they have staked their hold in the Republican Party on a crusading missionary foreign policy. And if Trump were to retreat to a more traditional, even isolationist foreign policy, that would represent really a catastrophe for them, because they don't feel ideologically sympathetic to the Democratic Party, but they really have nowhere else to go.
And just, James Galbraith, just to do an update on Oklahoma, Clinton is ahead 50-43, with Sanders with 43. Massachusetts, Sanders at 51, and Clinton at 48. So Sanders is doing well in Massachusetts. But just to, I rather facetiously touched on Donald Trump's economic plan, if indeed there is one. But could you actually? Could this country survive with a deal maker in as a president? Who, I mean, for example, one of the most shocking things after he'd announced he's a race and is that he was race entering the race and then insulted the Latinos, the next press conference he had, he brought out this Indonesian businessman who's a bag man for General Prabowo, the guy that lost the election, who's tied in with these hideous generals who murdered an enormous number of their citizens and have destroyed the ecology of Indonesia. And he sort of said, you know, we can do business with this guy. I mean, he reminds me more of a Putin or a Berlusconi or an Erdogan than any other leader we've ever had. So in terms of the foreign policy nightmare of having somebody like that, what would the economic environment look like?
Well, I think it would be extremely hard to run an economic policy through the optic of Donald Trump. He would have to overturn the entire existing international arrangements of the United States to come close to what he's promising to do. So I think it's fair to say that it simply wouldn't happen. But let's not get ahead of ourselves. The Republican Party is in the business right now, or in the process of nominating one of its most improbable candidates of modern history. And it's fair to say that barring some exceptional circumstances, he's not going to be a very strong candidate in the general, simply because his own party isn't going to support him. I was interested in Jacob's remark just now, because it strikes me that one area where he might be able to pull votes from the Democratic side is that if he turns out to be the candidate who embodies the lessons learned from Iraq and Afghanistan, and Hillary Clinton goes forward having to defend what she was responsible for in Libya, that could cause some problems for the Democratic nominee, should that nominee indeed be Secretary Clinton. So that's an interesting twist, and I don't know how significant it is in quantitative terms. People probably don't vote for the most part on their foreign policy preferences, but it is a point where he might have some strengths and she some vulnerabilities.
We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back with more of Background Briefing. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. Anthea, what's your sense then of at this point on the Republican side? Is it too late?
It's too late. I just saw a piece before we got on that there's a big meeting for a super PAC that they're trying to pull together now that to try to do opposition against Trump. Actually, this is one that was out before, and they ran commercials in Iowa, and he was number two, of course, right behind Ted Cruz. So the time to have done this probably was August, September, and I don't think they can get the same kind of momentum. What they're up against this time is that, you know, Trump has sort of that had perfect name recognition in the beginning. People knew him from a reality TV show. It became funny to everybody at first, and Republicans thought that this wasn't happening. But they actually made this candidate. They made this candidate back in 2008 when Sarah Palin was out saying the kinds of crazy things that he says now, and even more so in October of 2008 when she started talking about Obama palling around with terrorists and all of the, you know, racialized and kind of hateful comments that grew over the last 7 years. And, you know, people seem to also forget that he was a birther. And I never forget that.
Right.
And well, I think, yeah.
Well, I have a theory about that. I have a theory about that, by the way. You know, Trump necessarily wants to be president, but he wants to win the presidency. And I think his obsession with Obama, which began with this birther nonsense, it began at the press dinner when mm-hmm. at the night that Obama had killed bin Laden, and he made fun of Trump and the decisions he had to make on his reality show. And Trump was seething with such anger that I have a feeling that so much of this is, since the guy has an outsized ego, so much of this is an ego contest to begin with. I mean, maybe it's maybe I'm indulging in amateur psychiatrics here.
But, you know, I don't think that, listen, I mean, I think everybody can see that there's something really wrong with this man, okay? I just, you know, I have to be blunt and say it. It's sort of interesting to me that nobody will say, I mean, people are now starting to press against his lies, but he's been lying all the time. I mean, and compulsively lying. I mean, there's not, I think PolitiFact tried to do one of these things on him, and it's like, he was like, I don't know, some huge percentage of everything he had said in some last speech was a lie. So I'm not surprised, but I think you have a point about him wanting to do this, but I don't know that he knows what happens on the other side of it. You know what I mean? I think once he gets it, he might actually be tired of it. But I do think also what this says a lot about us as American people, and some of us, is that, you know, people are easily swayed by hearing statements about make America great again. There was a great piece also about Trump's language. You know, all the different candidates were about 7th, 8th, or 9th grade level. Trump's language is at a 5th grade level. So, you know, maybe even 3rd. I can't remember. It was pretty low. So the kinds of things that he's saying, on the one hand, seem very stupid, but they're also pithy statements that people can remember. And because of that, I think he's gained a lot of traction with low-information people, or the kind of people who listen to what I call the complex. And the complex is, you know, Breitbart, The Blaze, Fox News, all of those things that sort of work in tandem together to get out a certain kind of conservative message. And those networks have been growing for the last 6 or 7 years, and now Mr. Trump is reaping the fruit of all of that. They are his mouthpiece. Whether they like him or not, they are the mouthpiece for everything he says. And now so is the larger media.
So, Jacob Harbron, do you think that there was more to that statement than meets the eye the other day when Trump said, I love poorly educated voters?
You know, the question I have, and we talked about this the other night, Ian, is to what extent does Trump adhere to this authoritarian persona, and to what extent is he just playing everybody? I mean, does he, once he gets the nomination, go rogue on the Republican Party?
Well, I guess that's the option that he has. I mean, they're in a bind either way. Either he becomes a nominee and it's a catastrophe for them, or if they don't treat him according to his indications or his whims, he could run as a third party. So I think they're doomed either way, it would seem. What's your sense, James Galbraith? Is James back with us?
On the Republican Party, he doesn't mean doing something if he doesn't get the nomination. It means that if he does get the nomination,
right,
he's not under any discipline to conform to any of the norms that he's been, or any of the things that he's been saying in the primaries. So we really don't know what kind of general election campaign Donald Trump would run. We know that, and I think let's not underrate him. He is a very accomplished performer. He knows how to get his points across. He is appealing, as Anthea said, to voters who are not spending their lives hyper-analyzing the election, but he is reaching them with a clear and straightforward message from their point of view. And he has managed to keep the opposition entirely off balance and divided, so that he has got himself a path to the nomination at this point. So I think we should, having said he's a very problematic candidate, let's not dismiss the talent that was required to get him where he is today. And let's also not dismiss the fact that he could score some points on the Democrat. He is not going to go into this into the general election campaign with his eyes closed or with a hamstrung by anything in particular that he's ever said in the past. Just look at his record. He's transformed himself any number of times politically in the last decade or so.
Well, I think Bill Clinton warned the complacent Democrats that he would be formidable, and I think your point's well taken that he's extremely clever. But at the end of the day, it also feels deeply cynical to me that he's essentially promising the American people that they're all going to win the lottery if he wins the presidency.
cynical is not unknown in American political leadership. We have seen quite a bit of it in my lifetime.
Right.
One of the things I really like about the about the guy I'm backing is that he's presented a campaign which is not cynical at all.
No.
It is simply clear and straightforward, and that's been a minority position, certainly in my experience of politics.
And I take it you're referring to Bernie Sanders.
Yeah, sure. I mean, what Bernie Sanders has been doing now for the entire 10 months he's been running is making the same points and trying to reach additional people, to make it clear to them what it is that he would like to achieve. And so, you either like it or you don't like it, but it is reaching an ever larger spectrum of the American voting public that this is the agenda that he's putting before them. And that is a tactic which was, I think, done really only once before in my experience, and that was by Ronald Reagan. Clear, straightforward, rather reassuring. I didn't particularly like it in Reagan's case, but the effectiveness was enormous.
Well, what's your sense, Anthea, in terms of the questions about what Donald Trump really stands for in terms of what he might do, as opposed to how clever he's been so far, and he's likely to continue to be so, and he may well be quite formidable as a candidate against either Hillary Clinton or Bernie Sanders. And as Jacob has mentioned, in foreign policy, he may even move to the left of a Hillary Clinton in foreign policy. So he's a bit of a shapeshifter, and he's certainly somebody that can't be underestimated.
Oh, I absolutely agree. I think that one thing we probably need to really just put out here on the table is that Bill Clinton is right. Donald Trump has the potential to get all these blue dog Democrats. And that's what I think is very interesting. If you remember back in 2008, Hillary tried to play to these people, and she came here in Pennsylvania at the end of March, beginning of April of 2008, and made, tried to make some inroads here in Pennsylvania, because we have a lot of blue dog Democrats, people who've worked very hard, who are, relatively conservative, but have voted Democratic all their lives. And I think Trump could peel off of some of those people, so that's number one. Number two is I think that in the case of Bernie Sanders, and I wanted to bring this up because I think this is going to be an interesting problem when you ask me about Black Church, is that Bernie Sanders has had a problem with getting African-American voters. And I think if he could have made more inroads there and had started earlier, he has, a lot of people being surrogates for him that are, very well known in the community. What's not happening is that he's not getting the traction. And so tonight, probably, he'll win Vermont. He might, make a decent showing in a couple of the other states that are, northern states. He might make a decent showing in Minnesota. But the problem for him is going to be is how to, make some breaks into those votes if he wants to keep, a competitive race to July and the DNC. So that's going to be an interesting battle for him. I think, he has a very interesting and good economic message that would appeal to African-American voters and more broadly to voters of color. But I don't think, and this is the thing, it's the disconnect between how to connect with them. And the Clintons have had years and years and years of, of sort of making the inroads into especially the African-American community. And, Clinton is also someone who says, who now, saying that she is the standard bearer to continue President Obama's legacy. So I think that's a compelling thing for African-American voters.
We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back with more of Background Briefing. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. So, James Galbraith, given that the head is full of nonsense in terms of this campaign, particularly on the Republican side, so far, where you've had this kind of junior high school squabbles on debates, and I mentioned the heart and soul of the country may be up. Up is a kind of referendum. What is your pulse on this? Will this come down to a sort of contest between the kind of cynicism I've been talking about, which you rightly point out is pervasive in politics, and Hillary Clinton's call to the better angels of our nature?
If she can convey that effectively, then she will be doing, I think, very well for herself. Her challenge will be to persuade the electorate that this iteration of her political persona is the true one. In Trump's case, he doesn't need to persuade people that he holds to any particular views. I think Marco Rubio has penned a label on him that is entirely accurate, will stick, that he's a con man. The fact is that he is actually appealing to a significant part of the electorate for whom a successful con man is exactly what they want in the presidency, exactly what they want in their political leadership. And so from that point of view, just to take up the point that Jacob was just making, it may not even hurt him with anybody, with any significant part of the electorate that's backing him now, if he pivots on a whole range of positions in order to launch the most effective attack on his opposition in the general. So this is going to be very interesting and very challenging. I do agree that ultimately it will come to whoever Donald Trump is facing. It will come to a contest over the soul of the country, and the challenge of the Democratic nominee will be to really express a vision that a large number of people can rally around and that they really convey with conviction. This is going to be a problem. As we do remember that in 2008, this was exactly the way President Obama, Barack Obama, Senator Obama at the time, portrayed himself initially as a candidate of transformation, but then both in the general election and in the aftermath, he became a president of the establishment, not to put too fine a point on it, and that's why we have the rebellions that are going on today. So it's going to be hard for people to believe that they're going to get something different this next time around. As I say, persuading them of that is probably the key to success, but it's going to be a terrific challenge. Mm-hmm.
And Anthea Butler, what's your sense then of how, for example, Bernie Sanders can proceed? He's the truth teller, and he's clearly making enormous inroads. He's captured the populism on the left. Trump has captured the populism on the right. Bernie's is authentic, and as we've made clear, I think, and in all fairness, I think Trump is inauthentic, if not a con man. So how does an authentic reformer beat a phony kind of con man?
Well, the authentic reformer has to be, one, charismatic, and two, be the person who says, I am going to tell you the truth no matter what. And he has to, if he would become the nominee, he'd really have to press against all the lies that Trump has said and to try to pull together the party in a different kind of way. I think that Bernie's issue is, in a nutshell, is that he's very good at what he does, and he has not changed his message in 40 years, but he needs to retool that message for where he is right now. And what I mean by that is that it's a good economic message. It's a right message. But the ways in which the news cycle works and everything else in this country, the reason why Trump is able to suck the air out of everybody's space is because he does crazy things. And every time he does something crazy, he's like the kid who, you know, you're on the phone and your kid pulls something down and breaks something every time you're on the phone. That's Trump. Trump wants your attention 24/7, and he will take everybody's attention. So whoever runs against him has to figure out how to keep the attention posted on their campaign, the things that they're saying, to be truthful and to be honest. And I think, you know, Bernie Sanders in a lot of ways has a better chance at that than Hillary does, because there's so much baggage there. If Hillary becomes a nominee then against Trump, then that's really going to be a knockdown, drag out, really bitter fight to the end. And there's a lot of ammunition on both sides to use against each other. And I think that will be very troublesome indeed, and it doesn't help the voters. But I want to say one more thing about voters right now. I think the other part is that we're at March 1st. We've been going through this a very long time, and one of the things I wish would happen in America is that we would have a campaign like what happens in Britain. You're like 6 weeks or 2 months, and it's over with. We've been now going at this for about a year and a half, and we've got another 7 or 8 months to go, and people are already fatigued. And I can't imagine, at the rate that we're going right now, I wonder what happens to the voting population after another 7 or 8 months more of Trumpism and all the rest of the craziness that we've seen on, network television and cable news. So I think it's going to be a long slog, and I don't know how somebody rises above that to be a soaring kind of a candidate that Barack Obama made himself in 2008, vis-a-vis the knockdown, drag-out fight that I think is about to happen for the next few months between the Republican candidate and the Democratic candidate.
Well, I think very, very interesting points you've made, Anthea, and Jacob Harbin. Obviously, we should have a national primary, and staggering it out the way it is, obviously is incredibly good for the networks. And it was no accident that the head of CBS, Les Moonves, is rubbing his hands with glee at all how much money they're making. And that's one of the problems, is the media monopolies in this country have a vested interest in our broken political system because they profit from it so handsomely. So is there a possibility, as Anthea suggested, that one, we're going to be completely fatigued by the time we get to November and disgusted perhaps, and two, how can somebody, a decent person like Bernie Sanders, break through?
Well, I think it's going to be a brutal, ugly contest, and the Clintons actually excel at this kind of warfare. I guess the one other question I had for the panelists in thinking about this is, if people could get tired of Trump. I mean, I don't know how long he can sustain interest in his candidacy. But what a lot of people in Washington, D.C. are writing right now, including the Washington Post, is that he represents a dire threat, not just to the Republican Party, but also to American democracy. And I wonder if the other panelists think that the situation is that grim. The Post this morning came close to comparing him to Hitler.
I think they should go over the line. I would agree. I mean, you know, I've been saying this about him for a long time. I have a joke, and you brought up earlier, Ian, Left Behind, and I've been joking on Twitter, and I said I called him Nicholas Carpathia, who is the Antichrist candidate in the book. But, the bigger issue is for me, and I think where Trump is very dangerous, is that his rhetoric is not just Hitler-esque. It is going to get our country into trouble around the world. We have servicemen and women who are in dangerous places around this world who, every time Trump says something dumb about Islam, he says something about Muslims, he says, you know, we're going to go over there and bomb the shit out of ISIS, All of these things that he said over and over and over again, we're going to build a wall. He is destroying relationships that we have. And, you know, you may have your questions about George Bush and what he did and everything else, but the one thing I will give George Bush is that he never messed up with the Saudis because his family had a relationship. And he knew that he needed to draw people together about Islam after 9/11. And this is where Donald Trump is dangerous. He's a demagogue. He doesn't care. He will go into the bunker if he's president and leave the rest of us to burn. And so I think he's dangerous.
James Galbraith?
Well, let me beg to differ a bit. I'm certainly no fan of Donald Trump's, but there is a distinct difference between a carnival barker and the leader of a neo-Nazi party. I've seen such parties in Greece and other places. And in this case, I mean, we don't have the militias, we don't have the brown shirts that kind of a movement. So I'm inclined to think that if Donald Trump comes into the presidency, he's going to find the real world surrounding him in a very big way. We've already heard from our leading military officers that, and from the intelligence leadership, that no, he cannot order our soldiers or to commit illegal acts under that are illegal under international law. They're required by law to refuse those orders, and they will. So we're going to see, I think, a presidency that would implode rather dramatically in the face of the resistance of the permanent forces of the government, should Donald Trump actually get that far. You know, I can't be entirely sure of that, but I have a lot of confidence in the resilience of those institutions. But I could come back for a second to what Anthea was saying. I agreed with her almost all the way on the question of the length and the brutality of the campaign. But I think it would pose a very interesting dilemma for someone like Bernie Sanders to try and shuffle the deck to change his act to be someone different than what he is. I think the fact is that this was a candidate who, when he started 10 months ago, was completely discounted. It was going to be a sideshow that would be over within a short period of time. And what actually happened was that he tapped into an enormous part of the Democratic electorate, a clear majority, so far as I can tell, of the younger voters. Why? Because he presented them with something that they clearly want, which is debt-free education and health security. And they clearly don't have those things. Those are probably the two biggest things on everybody's minds and agenda in this generation. And having done that, he's made himself into a contender. He may not get all the way there, but he's done something quite extraordinary. So I think as he goes forward, his right strategy is to stick with what he's doing and let people vote on him, and then see when we get to the convention how the delegates are sorted out. After all, it is proportional representation all the way. He's obviously coming in close or ahead in the states which the Democratic nominee is going to have to carry in November. And that should weigh quite heavily on the news development of the campaign going forward. It clearly isn't over tonight, so we'll see what happens. But I wouldn't tell him he has to change his routine. I think he's done extraordinarily well with it so far.
And at this, can I ask a question?
Sure, go ahead, Anthea.
Yeah. Do you think he takes the VP if Hillary should get more delegates? Do you think he should be the VP or not? I've been going back and forth about this in my head, and I would like to hear what you have to say.
I think that's over my pay grade. The last time I was involved in a vice presidential selection, very peripherally, was in 1972. It didn't turn out well, so don't ask me questions.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I know that election. Okay, I won't.
But in general, though, James Galbraith, when people become disgusted with democratic governance, as many Americans are, they turn to more illiberal forms. And one of the cynical things that the Republicans have done, as Jacob pointed out, is they've created the gridlock that everybody's blaming the whole establishment, including the Democrats, for. So is there any, short of going in, drifting into fascism, is there any way that we can restore governance? And
oh, yes. Oh, yes, absolutely. And one of the things that absolutely has to happen 2 years from now and 4 years from now is a different breed of Democratic candidate, a breed of candidate which is younger, which is committed to reform, which is carrying the, something like the agenda that's being presented right now. That has to happen. If that happens, then the Democratic Party has a future. The gridlock can be broken. If we get the kind of candidates that were put up under the leadership of Rahm Emanuel and Debbie Wasserman Schultz, a group of people who, basically are trimmers, then I think that the chances are that the current gridlock will continue or simply get worse as the domination by the Republican Party of the legislative institutions becomes a permanent fact. So there really is a choice there, and one of the consequences of this campaign is that decision is going to have to be faced in the next 2-3 electoral cycles.
So let me turn to Jacob then for a quick summary of, as we close out here, Jacob.
I just see the main question for me is how will Hillary Clinton, if she gets the nomination, which I think is likely, how will she successfully take down Trump? And I think it's going to be much harder than she envisions because you have a candidate who defames himself. It's not like she can run a negative campaign and create a more negative picture of himself than he's already done, and it seems to work for him. So that, to me, is the conundrum of this election. How can a basically middle-of-the-road positive candidate with her own welter of scandals take on Trump? Because I could see him in a debate, presidential debate, simply unloading on her and telling her that she's lived with a sexual predator for decades and she should be ashamed of herself.
Well quick, sorry to cut you off, but a quick last word here from Anthea Butler.
I think the question is the electorate going to be driven by fear of having Donald Trump as a president, or is it going to be driven by the hope of having either a woman for a president or someone like Bernie Sanders, who is promising to bring some equality to people who need it in this country? I think that is the real question. And then the sidebar question is when does Donald Trump just absolutely lose it on TV? Because I think it's coming.
Well, James, I thank you all. And James Galbraith, again, the Chair of Government and Business Relations at the LBJ School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas and the author of Inequality, What Everyone Needs to Know. Anthea Butler, Professor of Religious Studies and Graduate Chair in the Department of Religious Studies at the University of Pennsylvania and author of The Gospel According to Sarah, How Sarah Palin, the Tea Party Are Galvanizing the Religious Right. And Jacob Harbron, Senior Editor at the National Interest and author of They Knew They Were Right, The Rise of the Neocons. This has been the Pacifica National coverage of the Super Tuesday presidential nomination contest. I'm your host for this hour, Ian Masters, host of Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And I'd like to thank Alan Minsky, the producer, and Graham Fitzgibbon, the other producer for today's program. Standing along the side of the